This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
Thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is Greg Norris. Greg is my oldest son. He has built, bought, renovated, listed, and sold hundreds of homes in both California and Florida over the last 12 years. He's currently retired from the flipping business and going to college full time. Greg, welcome to our show once again.
Thanks for having me.
Just a little background before you came to work with the Norris Group was around 2004. What did you do prior to that?
Well, I started off as a fire alarm equipment salesperson for a couple of years. I learned how to build a house from the bottom up, and I built a couple of those. It turned into an electrical apprenticeship, and I kind of worked my way up from being an apprentice to a journeyman, to a foreman, to a project manager and estimator. And then that's about the time that I came to work for you.
I remember a comment you told me in Rosamond that dealing with those homes was sort of like being on vacation compared to what you had experienced, which I thought, you got to be kidding me. You apparently had dealt with a lot more stressful situations in Rosamond, but I had not.
Commercial construction projects where you're dealing with 50 or 60 people and all the other trades and plans that are, you know, 50 pages thick and spec books that are 500 pages thick. It's just a whole different level of stress, for sure.
And penalty phases for not getting done on the exact date, et cetera.
Sure, yes.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you showed up at Rosamond. I was overwhelmed with that one, but that's you were underwhelmed, so that was pretty cool. What are the numbers of homes that you flipped, let's say, in both California and Florida last 12 years?
I think we've flipped somewhere around 600 in California and probably about 60 in Florida.
Okay. How does the price range vary in Florida to California? What's the typical range that you were dealing with in Florida versus California?
In Florida, I found that the properties that moved best were probably between the $200,000 and $400,000 range. You get outside that range, and the cheaper homes have too much competition, and the more expensive homes just don't move fast enough.
Okay. And California, was that price
range? California changed. I mean, when we first started in California, it was, you know, really depressed. You know, we were buying stuff for under 100 sometimes, but for the trustee sale business, I think typically we liked being in the $250,000 to $500,000 range.
Okay.
That was where we had the most success.
Not really completely different. I'm just curious. I know it's been a while since you paid attention to the trustee sales in Florida, but have their numbers gone down like California did?
Yes, I have occasionally went back to it over the last year that we've stopped, and the numbers are going down. The competition is still ridiculously stiff, and the prices are just so tight. I don't really understand how anyone's making sense of them.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I had a conversation with a guy who had flipped about 1,000 homes in an 8-year period in California, and at the end of the conversation, he said, "You know what's interesting about that? We didn't make a dime." I was like, "Oh my gosh." When he said that, I kind of thought that makes perfect sense, because I know you were shaking your head every time you left every day going, what the heck were people thinking? And I guess they were keeping money busy. That's about the only thing you can say sometimes.
They were probably servicing money. I think, you know, that's just the nature of capitalism. You know, anytime there's an opportunity, at first the margins are good, and eventually as everyone catches on, the margins shrink to basically where you get to make a living, and that's about it.
Yeah. Buying foreclosure properties at trustee sales or mortgage sales, if that's what Florida calls them, requires knowing, you know, exactly what's owed against the title. So did that process differ in Florida versus California?
Oh, extremely. I really had to understand title more. In California, I had a good relationship with a title company that literally just gave me a review and said, yes, you're bidding on a first. There's, you know, if there's any liens, here's the liens. They did all of the necessary checks for me, and basically I relied on their expertise to do something right. A couple of times they got things wrong, but I was able to, with my knowledge, discern when I saw something off, I guess. It took some experience. You could definitely make a mistake even with having a title company on. In Florida, they hand you a document that's about 80 pages long, and they say, good luck. So it's significantly different. And not only that, you have to deal with potential HOA liens that are very, very far past due, that may not have ever recorded the fact that the HOA hadn't been paid in 5, 6, 7 years. I mean, sometimes these foreclosures have gone on for a very long time. You had to estimate what those fees would be. It was definitely a much more complicated, much more dangerous waters to be swimming in out here in Florida with title.
Well, when you, okay, let's talk about that, because that's really significant to me, because I'm, you know, we're going to do the loan business. So we're going to get, mm-hmm. we're going to get that same pile of 80 pages. When, I mean, you didn't have the luxury of knowing what property you were going to win. So how many of these 80 page documents did you have to look at? You were bidding on, say, 20 properties in a day. How is that even possible?
You get good at it. You just have to start figuring out, you know, what you're looking for. I had the help of an attorney. We paid a high price for a short while. I caught on quickly. I mean, unfortunately, I already knew a lot about title, having gone to Ward Hannigan's class. But he definitely helped me understand what I was looking for. So an 80-page document, you know, basically what you're doing is sorting through and looking for the most significant ones. I mean, when they give you a 20-page, you know, promissory note, you don't need to read every page of it. You know, just there's certain things that you're looking for, like the date that it was recorded, what that number was, you know, and then looking for that same information in the foreclosure information, making sure that you're bidding on, you know, what is actually the first, making sure that there's no, you know, second in place that becomes the first. You have to watch out for things like that. You know, a lien that was recorded second, but then there's a, what's the clause? I'm slipping my mind, but were they a subordination clause?
Yeah, subordination clause. Yeah, that's.
Yeah, so I mean, it's, you really have to be capable of looking at the title documents and knowing what exactly it is you're looking for. It definitely took a little while, and we paid a few thousand dollars getting an attorney's opinion on certain ones before I caught the gist of it. But it's not a beginner's game.
Okay, you took special training for that too?
Well, when I went to Ward Hannigan's class, he takes a lot of time
right.
helping you understand title. I mean, I've grown in that knowledge through all of the foreclosure sales that we did, and you know,
I thought there was something. I thought there was something specific that you had taken in Florida at one point for title.
Well, I did go take a class on title insurance, and I thought that I was going to get answers there. I really didn't get too many answers there. It was more like a precursor class to becoming your own title company so that you could sell title insurance, basically.
Okay.
But it didn't really give me the answers that I was looking for.
When you're buying a trustee sale in California versus Florida, how often was the property vacant in Florida versus California?
In Florida, I would say the properties were vacant probably 50% plus of the time. In California, I think it changed in the beginning. There were probably a few more vacant properties. In the end, it seemed like there was almost none. So it changed. It varied. But in Florida, I think the process is so long that we had very few evictions to deal with in Florida in comparison to California.
Right. You had told me, I think the foreclosure process contains an eviction process. Is that what I remember correctly?
It makes an allowance for it, yes, but at the same time, we still had one person that, you know, fought for several months before we were actually able to get them out. So it's provided for, but it doesn't mean that it's necessarily going to happen. It probably makes the process a little easier. I mean, in comparison to California, where we fought some of these evictions for 6 to 8 months sometimes,
yeah,
at the worst, I'd say, you know, the worst I think we had out here was 3 to 4. So, and that was, it was rare. I mean, it wasn't anywhere near the trouble that we experienced in California.
The Florida homes, due to the length of foreclosure, were either, you know, you had an owner that lived there, didn't care, or you actually could have had a vacant home for up to 4 years. So was the condition of the Florida home different than California?
I would say no. At first, you know, I'd heard about, you know, there possibly being mold in the ducting and, those types of worries. I'd say in general, the houses were the same as in California. I mean, it was just the repair bills that were a bit of a surprise, because there were certain things that in California we would have never guessed would have been on the verge of needing to be replaced, and in a market that is not red hot, you've got buyers coming into the purchases wanting more. It's not like, you know, when the market's hot, they're willing to overlook certain things just because they want a deal.
Right.
When the market's not hot, they get pickier.
Now, okay, so what were some of those issues? And did it ever come from the kind of from the lender side of the world, where you thought you had a good roof, let's say, and the lender said, yeah, we're, you know, that needs to be replaced, like the inspector for the lender?
I don't remember it being the lender. It was usually the home inspection that caused the issue. Home inspections would typically let the owner know how old the home was and how much time was left before it was, you know, needing to be replaced. Unfortunately, asphalt shingle roofs out here, even if they're 30-year roofs, only seem to last about 15 years out here. So, you know, the lifespan of a roof in Florida has definitely decreased significantly from the sun and the moisture.
Okay.
Air conditioners, same. I mean, air conditioners that are only 15 years old in California, you would typically just service it. In Florida, they get used so heavily, they're pretty much toast after 15 years. Those were really the two major expenses that were the biggest surprise and most consistent issues.
Okay. When you're bidding on trustee sale properties, again, you're not knowing which one you're going to get. So you're appraising dozens of homes inside a pretty tight time frame. How did that process differ in Florida than in California as far as availability of data and kind of the accuracy of the number that you were able to come up with, usually from a seated position looking at a screen?
It was different in that it was something that I could do on my own because of the fact that a lot of the sales are held online. So if sales began at, I don't know, 10 a.m., you know, you could wake up at 5 a.m. in the morning, you know, look at which homes were still for sale, because a lot of them would postpone, or, you know, things that the day before looked like they were going to go to sale, the day of would have a different status. So, it was unfortunate in some ways, but in some ways it was fortunate, because instead of, I mean, like, say at the beginning of the day, there might be 125 files the day before the sale. The day of the sale, you know, 4 hours before the sale, all of a sudden it went from 125 potential sales to maybe 10 or 15. So the workload dropped significantly on the stuff that you actually had to concentrate on. That helped. You know, we learned to weed out the properties that we felt were the best risk. You know, the older homes, you know, we just found out the older homes with the higher repairs, we just never seemed to really make money on them. I mean, the repairs were always heavier than they thought. We always regretted getting into the heavy repairs because it sucked too much contractor resources.
Okay.
It just, never seemed to work well. I mean, anything that was above a $30,000 repair job, we usually regretted.
Appraising the property in Florida, was it as comfortable a process as far as access to data and being as accurate as you've been in California?
I'd say in a lot of ways it's very similar. I think the part that was different was really understanding that two seemingly identical homes across a major street from each other don't necessarily mean they're a comp. That one took a little while to sink in. We had a home that, I mean, even the tract name was the same. I don't know, Ridgewood, you know, phase one and Ridgewood phase two, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
The problem was is that if there were comps within a year of the property, you know, that was being sold in the exact same phase, they considered those superior over newer comps that were across the street. So you had to be very, very cautious about what you were doing with appraisals, because the appraisers are definitely looking for something inside that particular tract.
Okay.
And even the same phase. So that I did find more challenging. I had to be, you know, sometimes I only had one comp, but it seemed like sometimes I had model match comps. I mean, it was a strong comp. It appeared to be nothing wrong with the comp.
Mm-hmm.
And just, I had to realize that lack of plentiful resales was also problematic out here. I mean, we held on to certain houses for over a year and a half before being able to finally sell them. And the market didn't necessarily drop as in value, but there just weren't any buyers. There's just no buyers to show up for a certain product type out in the middle of, you know, cities that seemed like they should attract buyers. So I really had to learn that if I didn't have at least three comparable sales within the same track, within the same phase, within the last year, I was taking a risk on a buyer not showing up in the amount of time I needed them to show up in.
Okay.
And interestingly enough, I actually went back to California, and once I kind of understood that dilemma I was having in Florida, when I went back to California and looked at some of the most problematic houses we had, I also found that to be consistent as well. If I couldn't find three comps within the last year in the same track, it was usually a poor bet.
Okay. We got introduced to some new words in Florida. Chinese drywall, for one.
Yes.
So what were some of the things that surprised you there? You know, Chinese drywall, foundation issues, things like that, I got to be careful in the loan business. So just talk about those experiences and how... is it possible to avoid them?
Well, the Chinese drywall issue is complicated. The best you can do is get more educated at where it's more likely to show up. I had to learn that if the house was between a certain period of years, and I think that the years was like 2002 to 2007.
Okay.
I think those were the years. I'm not sure. That's going off my memory, and it's been a while since I... in, you know, mindsets. I can't say that I'm certain of that, but basically in the early 2000s, you're looking for previous sales. Like, so if I had a house that was built in those years, I would go back as far as I could find to find listings in the MLS. I would have to read through them and see if there was anything that gave me indication that this was a potential Chinese drywall home.
Okay.
Unfortunately, the cities don't keep track of who is, you know, what tracks have it. There's no, like, public service announcement going, you know, please be aware of these tracks because they might have Chinese drywall on them. There's just nothing to help you. So you have to get good at searching through the MLS data to do your best to mitigate the potential of that being a problem.
What was the cost of that problem? Just curious.
I'd say we got lucky because only half of the house had Chinese drywall for some reason. they used the correct drywall on the second floor, and they used only the incorrect drywall on the first floor.
Okay.
So it was probably about a $40,000 problem for tearing apart the bottom half of the house and putting it back together again.
Wow. Okay.
It's treated a lot like asbestos. Basically, you have to tear it all out. It has to have, you have to have all the suits on, the HEPA vacs to literally vacuum up every speck of dust, the copper corrosion issues, the special engineer that has to come out and, tell you where you got it. The time was just brutal. I don't know that you could buy the house cheap enough.
Right.
Even with knowledge, because there's always going to be somebody who thinks they can do it cheaper. But I definitely would never want to have a Chinese drywall house.
Okay.
I would be fishing for easier fish.
We'll make a point of not making a loan on a Chinese drywall house, if at all possible. Did we deal with sinkholes?
We didn't. Well, sinkhole was kind of a bad term out here in Florida. There's settling issues, and then sinkholes where you literally have the whole underside of your house being undermined
right.
by, the sand falling into some underwater stream or something. So, no, I would say we did not deal with sinkholes, but we did deal with the settling issues.
Okay. Are sinkhole areas kind of known, or is that can pop up anywhere?
Yes, you can. Well, there's certain cities that have a tendency towards having sinkholes.
Okay.
So you can get maps and you can see where most of the sinkholes are. But at the same time, I mean, I'm no expert on sinkhole. I never actually dealt with a sinkhole house. I more dealt with settling. So, I mean, there's certain things that you can do to get an idea where those sinkhole areas are. But I would say in general, it's not typically something that you're dealing with.
Okay. Well, we have a minute and a half left. You have some rentals in Florida. You have rentals in California. Basically, what's the difference? Let's say the price point in Florida versus rent in California, price point versus rent for like a condo that you've got.
I'd say it's probably 60% of the price for almost identical rent in Florida right now. The cash flow per dollar spent is significantly higher in Florida. That's changing. I mean, the available inventory for that is definitely getting soaked up quickly.
So the inventory is going down and the rent, do you feel like the rent is peaked out in Florida, or you think that's...
No, I think it's still climbing. It's not like it's fast climbing, but I see nowhere right now for the rent to go down. I only see one way, and it's up. There's just too many renters, not enough product.
Okay. Building in Florida, do you just notice lots of tracks? Because in California, we're catching up a little bit, but we're still nothing like we've been before. But in Florida, is there tracks all over the place?
I would say I don't see tons of tracks. What I do see a ton of in Florida is multifamily housing.
Okay. Well, that's definitely...
Lots of that.
Okay. Greg, we're out of time. I appreciate your input as we begin our loan business in Florida. Good information for both our borrowers and ourselves. So I appreciate your time.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.